Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Talk with Tenny. There's been much going on in the world today, and I want to give the number out if you'd like to call in. Area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. One of the things that we were scheduled to talk about tonight is psychiatric profiling and how people all around the country are, the United States and quite frankly all around the world, are being subjected to this constant drumbeat that we are violent and need to be controlled. Based on fraudulent information that is being disseminated by psychiatry and by legislators. I have been watching the news, and the Murphy Bill, which we've been talking about quite a bit at this point, Murphy was actually on a station today, and I got to hear him spread false information to the public, and I think that the media needs to be held responsible for allowing this information to be being put out to the public. So I'm just wondering if anybody out there has anything to say. I see a caller from area code 202.
Lauren, yes, this is your regular caller, Yvonne from Washington.
Hey, Yvonne.
I had asked about this, about the press a couple of other instances ago. And I don't know about the TV, but most newspapers have ombudsmen, or they have editorial boards. Pressure has to be applied, you know, from all places. So I don't know what – we should always find out who the producer and the governing board of editors of a newspaper are, so that we can send letters in. I think letters are better than telephone calls, but – if when we know that someone who is going to spread lies are going to be on a television station, it's a good idea to flood them with phone calls saying how objectionable it is. And also, if you're whatever market you're in, it's probably a good idea to try to develop these news sources. So that means that before some story like that breaks, you have to kind of develop a relationship about maybe sending information to them about different other things that are happening in your community or other, or try to educate them so that when, I don't like to say that you're prepping for when bad things happen, but when they happen, then people think, they usually call people that they know. And I think that's why some people that spread falsehoods are called, because that's on the top of their Rolodex list, is that person.
Well, I think
that means that everybody in all 50 states, even thinking, even if you're in a small town and there's only 5,000 people and you get a weekly newspaper or you get a USA Today, that we just have to really be active in letting press, TV, radio, whatever, that this is not true, and then to develop a list of people that we know that will be good in explaining both sides, because everybody is not up to being on camera and debating someone like Fulatory or DJ Jackie. But that's just my thoughts on that, is that we really, really have to call them out on the falsehoods, because I was just looking at this Fox News story. I didn't watch it, but I saw a Facebook note that there was some story about the involuntary treatment. I don't And I think that it's being overdone, and we're letting it happen.
We are letting it happen, and people who may be listening in, who would
letting
like
it happen.
To...
The press keeps doing it because it's a thing for some reason that they like.
Right, and if you're listening in right now and you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. We really do need to be speaking out to the media and letting them know that the way that they're representing this information is not acceptable. And even if, well, I don't even want to go there, but the language that's being used, it's like the early 90s again with the ticking time bombs and the madmen and, you know, the deranged and it's very concerning because they're putting out this messaging to the public that this is accurate and that there's some kind of science behind what psychiatry offers and that psychiatry can somehow stop these massive tragedies from occurring.
And
we need to...
And out last night, really, Lauren, they're not really massive. My heart goes out to the people, and I say it now, I really go back to the family members of those young people that lost them. I think about Martinez, the father who was saying that, you know, it's the cowardly people. Because, no, this young man and several of the other people, we cannot prevent all bad things from happening. And when you have somebody who is like this particular shooter and the shooter in Newtown, where they had the best insurance, they were under care. And the thing about it is that there's guns, and we had to decouple the conversation from mental health and violence. Mental health, as people know, and as they want to be engaged in it, maybe does need more funds. But it is not going to be helped by turning a blind eye and trying to make like these tragedies will be avoided if we all of a sudden have 100,000 new beds we can put people in.
And for people to understand that the motivation behind using these kinds of tragedies and sensationalizing this is specifically so that they can, what they're calling, quote-unquote, reinstitutionalization, so that they can open up the institutions again and have people who are, quote, not fit to be walking among other people put back into institutions. And people also need to understand that anybody can wind up finding themselves in a position of where they're being faced with a 72-hour hold where they can be detained and assessed and treated while it's determined whether or not you need to stay longer. And in some places like Colorado, there's currently efforts being made to be able to hold people for 5 days to be evaluated, which would really equate to 9 days if you wind up in there on days with weekends. And so everybody needs to understand that if you lose a loved one and you go to the doctor and the doctor determines that you have been grieving too long, that is now considered a quote-unquote mental illness, a psychiatric label that will necessitate you being on drugs. And if you are rich or have private insurance at the moment, you're not necessarily going to be as affected by the things that we're talking about. But if for some reason you're like a lot of us who are working and somehow your pay is eliminated and you lose your job and you're living check to check, within a very short amount of time, you're going to wind up within the state system. And so it's very important to understand that economics very often is at the base of why it is people are winding up in the psychiatric system in the first place, and that we need, as a society, we need a trauma-informed care model that really treats people with respect and dignity and doesn't have it as their goal to lock them up and drug them. And so...
people that have had this the experience of the of the involuntary commitment to come on the line. Now, when I was hospitalized, I have to say I was lucky that it was in the midst of the Clinton administration when they first instituted the Family Leave Act. But even many people don't understand that the Family Leave Act, if you kick that in, it does not mean that you get paid. So some people only get 1 week or 2 weeks of vacation time. So if you get locked up and they hold your job for the amount of time, 12 weeks, leave without pay, and you go back, if it's a small employer, less than 50 people, which many people work for, you don't have a job that you have lost. And not only that, if you live in an area like where I live in Washington, D.C., where you have a defense industry and government, the fact that you've been institutionalized may interfere with some security clearances that you might have. So, you know, it's not a benign thing. People just say, oh, they just hold you for 3 days. But you will be in a database somewhere that you went and you had received mental health care. So it has a lot of wide range repercussions that you don't know. It might interfere with you being able to serve in the military. I mean, they say they don't.
Right.
Or
if you're a veteran coming home, that you're now going to be also likely to be subject to this also, and so it winds up affecting you one way or the other, and so it's people really need to realize that this is a major problem that we're facing. I just want to flag a story that I was sent earlier today that came off of NPR, and the title of it is, under the section on treatments, the title is "The Military Plans to Test Brain Implants to Fight Mental Disorders." And the article reads, "The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is launching a $70 million program to help military personnel with psychiatric disorders using electronic devices implanted in the brain. The goal of the 5-year program is to develop new ways of treating problems, including depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, all of which are common among service members who fought in Iraq or Afghanistan. Quote, we've seen far too many times where military personnel have neuropsychiatric disorders and there's very few options, says Justin Sanchez, a program manager at DARPA. DARPA is known for taking on big technological challenges, from missile defense to creating a business plan for interstellar travel. In 2013, the agency announced it would play a big role in President Obama's initiative to explore the human brain. It goes on to say that the new program will fund development of high-tech implanted devices able to both monitor and electronically stimulate specific brain circuits. The effort will be led by scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, and Massachusetts General Hospital. And then they go on to say that simple brain stimulation devices are already used, and so on and so forth. So I think that, again, we're testing, not only are the veterans not being given medical care when they're coming back, they're creating secret lists that they're, in order for people to get bonuses and to support their own, platforms, and that they're being drugged and electroshocked and when they come home. But now they're also going to be the subjects of a military program where they're going to be using implanted electronic devices in their brains.
Mm-hmm. This is like science fiction. This is like cyborgs. Now, they didn't happen to mention that they had tested it out on some people yet already, or that they use it in animals.
But if they've already, it starts to make things seem very suspicious, like the Alexis, the Navy Yard shootings, right? Because if they're at the point of where they're announcing it to the public that this is part of their intention, the idea of the government sending radio waves into somebody's brain in order to control their behavior, becomes an entire new type of situation that we have to take in a more serious way. The same like we were talking about the other night with the smart pills. You know, somebody saying that, you know, they took a pill that has a chip inside of it that is controlling them or monitoring them. And, well, that's a reality now. And so people need to understand the realities of the society and the culture that we're in. And I'd like to talk a little bit about some other things that I've seen people talking about, but I want to give out the number. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167.
Dawn, before you go on to that, and I hope that someone, other people that have these experiences will come on, you made a mention of the Navy Yard shooting. You know, I live in Washington, D.C. For 28 years, I lived like virtually two blocks from the Navy Yard. I don't know whether people know it or not, but that was one of the things that the Navy Yard shooter claimed, that they were bouncing waves off of him.
Right.
And, in fact, the way that psychiatry picks up in this is this guy was getting several antidepressants that were known to cause sleep problems, and he had actually gone to at least, I don't know how many, but at least two places complaining about sleep. And I guess that he need to, like you said, hold the news media to account and take these stories apart, because there's often, when people make comments like the chips in the brain and radio waves, we just think that, and I don't think, but oftentimes people think, oh, that just confirms that they're not right, but they're here, and if we haven't tested and they announced that they are going to do this, to me that leads me to think that they've already done it before.
Right, and there are all of these examples that we have throughout history of where this happens, and the reason I brought up the Navy Yard was exactly for that, because that's exactly what he was saying. And he had been, correct me if I'm wrong, but he had been military or working.
He had been in the military himself.
Right.
He was a contractor. He had been in the military. And I guess the District of Columbia, there's no place to buy a gun. But he bought one in Virginia, and he had been to two. He had been going from place to place as far as his job, and he had gone to two places I count. There may have been more, but I don't want to misreport. He had been to two places, and he complained of sleep. And one of the drugs he was taking is known to cause kind of like insomnia effects.
And to have amnesiac properties and also have memory loss from the drug.
Sleep deprivation can cause things to look like, you know, that is the biggest thing about for people is not getting enough sleep, and that can cause many problems.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, I just to reiterate what NPR put out in this article, again titled "The Military Plans to Test Brain Implants to Fight Mental Disorders," is that they will that this through this Obama's initiative, that this program will fund the development of high-tech implanted devices able to both monitor and electrically stimulate specific brain circuits. So there's no secret with MKUltra and all of this other stuff that for decades the government has been trying to find ways to control, for mind control. And now they are entering into, and that they are testing this on veterans. You know, one of the things that people often tell me when they discuss like the effects of having been electroshocked or something, some people who voluntarily went through it with the idea that they had informed consent when they really didn't have the information that they needed about the resulting effects, was this idea that you can be so desperate and in so much pain that anything to try to alleviate the pain is worth trying. And when you think about the post-traumatic stress that veterans are many of them are coming back with from what they've experienced at war, right? The most unnatural state for us to be in. That, you know, out of that desperation, they may agree to be part of this research, if they're even informed that they're part of research. You know what I mean? That's always the other big question.
It's easier to give pill, but I know maybe you might not have time tonight, but I think at some point it might be good to discuss some of these terms, for example, like informed consent. Because many people think, for example, when they go to the pharmacy and they get the little 2-inch insert about the medication, or maybe the doctor tells you to take this and he gives you a 1-sentence statement, they may think that they're getting informed consent. Same thing if they're involved in any clinical trials. Sometimes people, they really don't understand that the informed consent means all the way through the process, and then even if new information becomes available about the study, or even if it's not a study, but if you're getting a treatment, that there's a duty to explain to the person what it is, and you know, the little 2 or 3 inches is not informed consent. I found it very interesting. A lot of people don't understand that the reason why when you go to a pharmacy, if you notice, everyone notices this, they'll notice this tomorrow or next day when you go to a drugstore. Look on the side. They have a couple of chairs. They may either have it stand-up booth. They may have something for consultations. Well, they don't have that there because they just feel nice about it, because they'd love to have that space taken up with more food groups. They actually have to have that. So if you have any questions to ask, but most people don't ask questions of the doctor. They think that 2 or 3 inch information is not enough. If you ask, in most cases, if you ask for the manufacturer's insert, I know one of the medications that I took years ago was 25 pages. And in my stupidity, I was actually asking for it because I was afraid that something would happen. But then when I got the manufacturer's insert and I had such side effects, I said, oh, no, this is a bad thing. I didn't even have to say, take me off. My doctor said it's not doing what it claims to do. You don't have any reason to be on it. But this informed consent notion, maybe at some point people need to know that they're not getting all the information about chemicals or about the treatments they're getting. And I'm quite sure they're not getting about implants.
I think that is absolutely true, and that people, you know, when you really take the time to look at what informed consent means, first of all, it's not a one-time deal. It's an ongoing process, especially if you're involved in research. Informed consent is an ongoing process. And it requires that somebody be fully explained every potential side effect, and for people to understand that things that are considered benefits are also considered side effects. So side effects can be either positive or negative, and to specifically state whatever known risks there are. And if you're in as a somebody who's a participant in research, to be informed of any unknown potential risks. In other words, it may potentially cause you to die. And that's one of the reasons why so many of the drugs have a potential side effect of death, because in the research studies, they showed that people died from them. And so people need to like really reorganize the way that you're thinking about doctors, and that just because somebody is a doctor doesn't mean that what they're giving you is, and because it's legal, doesn't mean that what they're giving you is good and necessarily going to help you. And so if somebody with informed consent and choice, in a big part of informed consent is that you have options and alternatives, and an alternative is not either do this or do that. An alternative implies that there's a variety of different things that you can do to alleviate your experience and to improve your the way you feel. And people aren't told about the free and sometimes easy kinds of things that they can do in order to improve their situation. But the idea that our government is actively planning and investing $70 million into this idea of electronic devices implanted into the brain to be tested on veterans, as a country, we should just be ashamed of ourselves. We should just absolutely be ashamed of ourselves.
The fact that they're putting this out and they don't have more information, you know, if you were going to a hospital and you were going to have an operation, you'd have lots of questions to ask the doctor. You'd want to know, how many times has this person done this procedure? Has it been done elsewhere? But, you know, they put that out, and it really, I guess it's the cockiness. I say that, you know, many times, decades ago, I had bought the Kool-Aid too. I said, you know, this person is an MD. They have 20 years of schooling, 5 years of residency. They've been in practice for a long time. You don't think that maybe they don't know about this drug, they don't know about this procedure. What makes what they're saying any greater than something else that somebody else is saying, where maybe it might have worked, but they don't have the little initials behind their name? And that's why I think that what I say is that, for me, I'm not as harsh as somebody. I said, my problem is that I don't think that people have informed consent, just like about these devices. I mean, I can't imagine them putting a device, well, I can't imagine it. They're going to put a device in, and like I said, the question you would ask is, have you put this device in other people?
What they're planning on doing, I also just want to give the phone number really quick. If you'd like to call in, it's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. All of this is related, I just want to say, to things like the Murphy Bill, which will cause the government to have more control over people and lower the standards for people to be involved with psychiatry. So if you've got something to say about H.R. 3717 or the current system, or talking about if you're a veteran or know somebody who's been through something like this, 267-521-0167. You know, that article on NPR, they specifically say that that they're going to be starting this program by looking at people that they're going to be working with, quote-unquote, epilepsy, Parkinson's patients, and that the UCSF team will begin its work by studying volunteers who already have probes in their brains as part of treatment for epilepsy or Parkinson's disease. That will allow researchers to, quote, record directly from the brain at a level of resolution that's never been done before. Said Eddie Chang, a neurosurgeon at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, right? They're one of the people that's sharing the $70 million with DARPA. So they say that by monitoring the electrical activity of brain cells, the researchers will be able to study how brain circuits behave in real time, Chang says. And because many of the volunteers also have depression, anxiety, and other problems, it should be possible to figure out how these conditions have changed specific circuits in the brain. Chang says, quote, if we are able to understand how the circuit has gone awry, that may give us some very critical clues as to how we may be able to reverse that, he says. Once the scientists have those clues, they hope to design tiny electronic implants that can stimulate the cells in faulty brain circuits. Quote, we know that once you start putting stimulation into the brain will change in response. So they are clearly working in a level here of where they are going to be going after people, causing brain damage, right, because you are stimulating the brain with electricity, electrical probes, planted right in, that they are watching and can perceive, record your brain circuits in real time.
Oh, wow.
these are the things that these are the things that are going to wind up seriously creating a whole new kind of world that we're going to have no choice but to deal with. I have a caller, area code 609. You're on the line, area code 609.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to join in the discussion.
Great, you're on the air. What's your name?
Okay.
What would you like?
My name is Jason.
Hi, Jason.
I'm calling from South Jersey. Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about deep brain stimulation.
Well, they're going to be working with people who have deep brain stimulation, but this is different this would be different, and it would be more expansive and more invasive in terms of how they would be, you know, mm-hmm. manipulating actual brain circuitry. But that it would be implanted, so very in some ways similar to deep brain stimulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I listened to your show last night, and it was really good.
Thank you.
And I was at the protest in New York also, and I was at the one in Philly. I guess that was 2012. And,
oh, great.
Because I had electric
shock
there. So, yeah, the APA, yeah. I've been to two, and I did see you there. I didn't really talk to you, but I'm trying to get more involved in this, you know, activist stuff. And I've been, I've been electroshocked. 3.5 years ago, I was electroshocked. They violated consent. Well, the consent is lousy. I mean, it's really a joke to begin with. But they did things to me when I was right before I went under for the treatment, and they changed electrode placement. And the psychiatrist who did it is also involved with deep brain stimulation and other and transcranial magnetic stimulation and TMS and things like that, which I actually have an implant.
You have an implant.
I do. I have the vagal nerve. It's a wire attached to my vagus nerve. It was put in before. I was involved in a study at the University of Pennsylvania at their depression treatment clinic. The same guy who shocked me. When everything else he did wasn't working. But, I was deteriorating. I saw him for about 6 years, and I was deteriorating, depressed. But I'd already been on, I'd been on drugs for over 20 years. I'm off of them now. I've been off, it'll be like 4 years where I haven't had any of the drugs. But I was already damaged, already having memory problems, totally run down and sick, And I was involved in a study there.
If this is too much of a question to answer, just tell me to mind my own business. But would you be willing to talk about what the informed consent process was like, and maybe what you wished it would have been like, or what really worked about it, if it really worked? But because you mentioned something about informed consent, not really.
Yeah. It's my family was involved. Also, I don't remember really anything about it. Personally, I mean, all the information, what I know about it is what I got from my family afterwards. I've seen the consent forms that I was given. I've seen some of my records. The current, for electroshock, the current consent forms, I mean, they minimize everything to the point where it seems like a totally benign procedure, and and just the fact that they tell you, you're desperate, whatever, and they tell you that, that the seizures are safe, and that the stimulus
But you lost some memory. You don't even remember the forms.
Oh yeah, I don't remember. I have the form somewhere. You know, I've done a lot of reading about it, so I know a lot about it now. But
so
a total, they just locked. I mean, the doctors, I was coerced in a gentle, way. I'd been telling this doctor that I wanted to get off drugs for like 2 years, and he'd been pressing me to do electroshock for a couple of years, and nothing was making me feel better, and I was feeling sick and horribly depressed. And they said, you come into the hospital for 2 weeks. I was supposed to do 6 treatments. They ended up doing 23. They did something called bifrontal ECT, which isn't done a lot. I don't know why he did it. I suspect it has something to do with that. He does TMS, so I think he was just sort of experimenting with me. And most of the treatments were bifrontal, and this is where they would probe with the with a lobotomy pick. That's where the electrodes were placed, on my forehead, and I talked to other people who have, had bitemporal and right unilateral. That's what I was supposed to have, 6 treatments, right unilateral. I was in the hospital for like a month and a half, I'm just having serious problems functioning. I mean, I'm a mess. And the consent is just, they just minimized the memory loss and didn't mention anything about, cognitive disturbance, cognitive dysfunction. I did have testing done like 6 months after, extensive testing, and it showed that I have severe executive function impairment.
From the shock.
And from the shock, yeah.
We don't want to talk about anything that's bad, but that would emotionally hurt you, but I just want to ask this question, and I'm going to say the same thing as Lauren said. If it's uncomfortable, please, say something about it.
Yeah.
Did it work?
Yeah.
Was the ECT what they said it was?
No, not at all. I mean, I wasn't told I was being brain injured. I wasn't told I was having my, I was about to have my brain scrambled and my life erased. I wasn't told anything like that. They describe it as a gentle, safe procedure, and it's not, and none of the treatments are, pharmacological. They're all invasive and they're all damaging, and all the studies, start out by saying, this is a proven safe and effective treatment, and none of them are. And I really don't know what other than
the memory loss. You talked about cognitive impairments or scrambling, and using all those big words, could you say how was it different after the ECT?
Well, for about 9 months, I was in bed recovering. Yeah, I mean, I was, and I still spend most of my time in bed, and when I'm not in bed, life is chaotic, and I have extreme anxiety. I'm not as depressed. I'm certainly it's not, but I have no real memory of what I was like before, And even my whole drug history, I have no real strong recollections of what 20 years of taking every drug and every combination. I have no real.
Missed anniversaries and relationships?
It's gone. It's like I describe it to my family and other people. It's like I'm off the grid. It's like I don't exist. It's like a social death. It's like I died. And I'm in a constant state of, panic and duress that I have to spend all my time just trying to stay calm. I've become angry, explosive. And, you know, and I'm scared because I can't go, I can't use these services for help. I can't go to the, I can't trust anyone, you know. I'm afraid. The psychiatric system is scary because when you're, you know, when my social supports are kind of have broken down and I'm just, I live in fear, you know, because I've been so damaged that, and it's like they've taken away my personal, you know, resources. I used to be a creative person and I don't do any of that anymore. I just feel like,
it sounds like you've been through the ringer.
I want to support you, but I also, the reason why I'm asking this is not that I'm trying to hurt you, that if it is comfortable for you, because other people don't understand about these treatments. How do you know that you were a creative person before?
Well, I have artwork. I have lots of artwork and other things. You know, I have all my possessions and things. You know, that's what I mean, I still have some knowledge of it, but when it's like there's no emotional connection to who I was. It's like my identity is just gone. I don't know how to. They say it's going to relieve your depression. You know, I guess I was hoping that I would feel better and be able to do the things that I wanted to do, and that's not what's happened to me. I know a lot of other people have been through that too, like Linda Andre, and you know, now all I do is read about psychiatry and think about it, and you know, I'm on a different path now. It's permanently altered everything. I mean, and it's like an unwanted, unplanned, you know, transformation, but not in a good direction, really. The only thing I have is this, you know, hoping that I can help, you know, just help other people. I'm still involved with I use a self-help center around here, a community self-help, you know, a self-help center, which is safe. Everyone there is heavily drugged, and most of the people are heavily drugged, and I've been trying to, you know, wake people up and give them good information and start like a hearing voices group and do some alternative things, and that's what I try to tell people, but it's hard to get through when people are so heavily drugged and are so, because that's how I was too, you know. I know that before the electroshock, you know, everything what I thought about myself, everything was in terms of symptoms, every feeling I had, if I was having a bad day, you know, it was all, I need to see the doctor, I need a new med, you know, I went through all that for years and years, but I really don't, really, the past is just, it's vague. The memory loss is extreme.
You're a very brave person. I just want to say, I don't want to stop you from talking, but I just wanted to say that I know it takes that a lot out of a person to talk about this horrible torture that you had. I want to say that I wish that I could give you a hug around the radio right now.
Oh, thanks.
I applaud your work for trying to tell other people about the dangers. You know, a lot of times, you know, people just don't really understand, you know, the deep dangers. And when someone like yourself comes up and witness, and I hope that other people will come on tonight or tomorrow to witness, because sometimes people just, they don't really get a full effect of how these things can, how they can affect you so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to share? You said the people at the self-help place are very drug.
The majority of them are.
When you say heavy, what does that mean? How are they acting?
Well, they're just, you know, a lot of them are you know, people come in and they give injections of long acting, you know, they give the, I don't know what they're called, the monthly injections of neuroleptics. Most of the people are, you know, they're lobotomized. They're chemically lobotomized.
Right. I think for people who may be listening, who may not be familiar with any of this and trying to get a grasp on another view of psychiatry, it's important to understand that one of the early goals of the drugs was to create brain damage, and that was seen as a success of being able to damage the brain, and they are continuing to do it. I just want to interject with a phone number for 1 second if you'd like to call in and talk. Jason, please stay on the line. But if you'd like to call in and talk, the number is area code 267-521-0167. First-time callers, most welcome. Area code 267-521-0167. Jason, you said that you had the vagus nerve implant?
Yeah, that was. I was involved in a study at UPenn, you know, the academic with this guy. Yeah, and I do have the implant. It's not on. I don't remember details of the study, but I do have an implant. It's like a pacemaker-like device that's on my left side below the collarbone, and then there's a really thin kind of like, it's almost like a thin vine, a rubbery wire that's attached to my vagus nerve, and they can't really take it out. I would like to have the device taken out. They can't take the wire out because they can damage the nerve. I could lose my voice. I could die. I mean, it's really an important nerve. I know that. But you know, right now, you know, with
and
the fallout.
And probably if you had come back, you wouldn't have had it put in, right?
If I had known, I mean, if I had
probably known that, you wouldn't have had it put in. Like I said, you have no memory of.
Oh,
that,
yeah,
but
I'd never have had it put in. I didn't know anything about, you know, antipsychiatry. I didn't know anything about the movement or anything before this, before the electroshock. That's what it frightened me so much that, you know, I found out about Peter Bregan and Mad in America and Leonard Frank, and, you know, and all that stuff, And just the ramifications, you know, just being able to it is torture, and the treatments are torturous. That's all, and it's all coercion, and it really is a criminal
activity.
Yeah, it really is.
And
the part, you know, and I had no idea, you know, I thought I was seeing doctors. I just didn't know. I didn't know about any of it. And reading Thomas Szasz has been a huge influence. His explanation of psychiatry and what they're really doing has been a pretty big influence. All of his books and articles and all the people, you know, I just have so many books now. I have a whole library about all this stuff, and I try to follow it as best I can and stay up to date and get involved with some of the it really is a political issue, not even really a health matter. I mean, it's
totally political.
I'm
just wondering, I mean, because you've expressed the fear of psychiatry a couple of times now, and I think that's something that a lot of us share. And with things like the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, and the current way that where people with psychiatric labels are being presented to the world through the media right now, do you have any thoughts about that? Have you ever had to, you know, is there some way that somebody could, against your will, turn that back on? Do you have to, do you know what I mean? Or are you now, to some degree, does it happen? Is there a switch? I don't mean to make light of it.
Yeah.
But I don't mean to make it sound like I'm making, but it, literally with the device, You said it's off now, right?
Oh, yeah, the vagal nerve. Yeah, all it does is the device is off, and when it was on, they gave me magnets. I had two wrist magnets, and you would hold the magnet over, and it would stop the device. There's a small battery in there, and it would shut it off. It would interfere with the battery somehow. But it's off. It's totally inactive. It can't be turned on, you know, remotely or anything like that.
I don't know if you were listening earlier with what the military is doing with the that was where we started, right?
My first thought on that, the profiling and all the shootings I just thought, you know, it's just more scapegoating. They just use these instances of violence. And it seems like a lot of the times the shooters or the perpetrators are really victims themselves of psychiatry. And it's like this loop of violence and scapegoating. I mean, go ahead.
Number again, 267-521-0167. If you want to call in, you can. It's 267-521-0167, and we're giving the phone number because some people are seeing this on the internet. Mm-hmm. You go to Blog Radio. If you don't want to use your telephone time, you can get this at Blog Radio Tinny. Is that correct, Lauren?
It's blogtalkradio.com/talkwithtinny.
Mm-hmm.
And then you click the link in button and I should be able to link you in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the labels, right, that this is part of the problem, right? Fraudulent labels.
It starts there, you know. It really starts there. That's where it started with me. I was depressed and, really just depressed as a young man. I was 18 and didn't have really any direction in life. And I saw a psychiatrist got a label and then got some medication. And then became psychotic. You know, I had a reaction to drugs. I was hospitalized, and that's where the journey started. And it starts with a label. It all looks so innocent,
right?
You know. You think you're being helped, and you're just sucked into the system and turned into a mental patient.
And so when you say depressed, because a lot of people hear this word all the time, but they don't really know what it means, could you describe what you were feeling, what you were seeking out help for, what you were saying to doctors?
Okay. Originally, I guess lost motivation. You know, I would isolate. I would spend very low energy, spending time in bed, not wanting to get involved. And that's what happened. I think I spent 3 or 4 months like that before I saw anyone, and someone suggested I see a psychiatrist.
Not to be a psychoanalyst or anything like that, but...
Yeah. Well, I wish... I think that's what I thought, you know, when I was... I'm sorry. I think that's what I thought I was getting into. I was going to see someone to talk about my problems with. And that's not what happened. One of those early antidepressants, which I had a reaction to, and I became totally manic and psychotic. You know, I had a reaction after 2 weeks of being on that drug. I came out of whatever state I was in, the depressed state, and was like awful. You know, awful. I became ecstatic. I felt great, and I wasn't suicidal. I wasn't a danger to anyone, but I was put in the hospital and tortured for 5-6 months. So with drugs, and then put on lithium, and, you know, and I believed I needed it. I was told I was sick and would need to be on this I was a manic depressive, and I would need to be on these drugs for the rest of my life in order to function. But like with a spellbinding, you don't really know that. I felt sick all the time, you know, chronic weight gain. I gained 60 pounds. I chronic sweating, chronic diarrhea, just feeling ill from these drugs. And everyone around, you know, my family would tell me, you've got to take this stuff. You know, you need it. And then after 15 or so years, you know, eventually I started to get a clue and I wanted to get off. And that's what I was telling the doctor who electroshocked me. I was like, I know I was telling him that I wanted to get off the drugs, that they were, but I was afraid to, you know, I was afraid because you start to withdraw and you have the withdrawal reaction, which seems like, you know, it feels like you're going nuts. And I know that now, but I don't know what you're going to say before.
Were you informed about the potential for withdrawal from the drug before you started taking it?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I've seen many different people over the years in different states, in Maryland, in Baltimore. Now I'm in New Jersey. The system here is pretty bad. And no, I don't think I was ever told that, you know, about the withdrawal. And I do try to get, you know, Will Hall's stuff with the
Nicholas Project.
Yeah, I have his booklet. I've given that to some people around here who have shown some interest, because I did do an informed choices group which touches on some of the alternatives. And that information in Will Hall and the Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs book is really good, because I still look at that, even though I'm not taking anything. But it's really because the electroshock, everything was so, you know, they were planning on putting me back on lithium, on more drugs. I mean, they didn't tell me this. They didn't tell my family, but that was in my charts, and they were planning on doing maintenance ECT once a month and putting me back, you know, on drugs right away, and they tried to. I saw the psychiatrist like two or three times afterwards, and I tried to give him information about electroshock. I'd printed some things up. He would not look at it. He said it wasn't reputable. The sources weren't reputable, and he just wanted to get me back on drugs, you know, keep me in chains, and keep me under his whatever.
Were you forced into any of this, or have you ever been subjected to forced treatment?
Yeah, I have. I have in being locked up. I have, you know, been forcibly injected. I've been in straitjackets. I've been held in solitary for a month, and things like that. But that was when I was 18. I haven't really experienced any long-term stuff like that. But you know,
I just want to say this, since you were telling your story, and as I always say, it is uncomfortable to let us stop. And I'm not trying to be funny. I know the answer to it, but I want to say this because people have been touting people getting this forced treatment. Was any of that forced treatment helpful? I mean, did
no,
it work?
No. I think it was all damaging. I mean, they tell you that, you know, if you get too excited or you're too emotional, you need to, you know, they need to stabilize you and this and that, which just means drugs. I mean, it just seems to me that it doesn't work. It's never really helpful in the long term or for real healing. And that
did you get a renewed respect for the medical profession?
Well, that's to me, that's the frightening part, is that they are respectful and it seems so benign, but it's all like because they're telling you that they're doctors and this is medicine, but none of it's true.
Right.
So
I want to give out the link, if I can, to the harm reduction guide to coming off psychiatric drugs and withdrawal that Will Hall and others put together. And you can find that at willhall.net/coming-off-meds/. And that there's some really good guidance for people if they're looking to find out information about this. It is a great source, and it's a shame that the psychiatrist that you were dealing with said that it wasn't reputable, because it was created with a 55-member, I'm just reading here, a 55-member health professional advisory board providing research assistance and more than 50 collaborators involved in developing and editing. And so it is definitely something that has been well-researched, and that there's a lot of people that have relied on the methods that are set out in the harm reduction guide to coming off psychiatric drugs and withdrawal. And for people to understand that the withdrawal process can make you really, you know, that it can be a really difficult process, and that there are ways to get through it that are safe and effective. And the I also want to just give the number again. It's area code 521, area code, I'm sorry, area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, if you'd like to call in and talk.
And Lauren, we should say this too, because people will oftentimes accuse people who were trying to get the truth out of telling people not to take their medication. What we're saying is, if you don't want to take these chemicals, which we say are harmful to you, is that you should not just suddenly stop taking your medication, and that you should get lots of support to do this. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't, you know, just stop taking medication over 24 hours. You should get lots of support. And I would say, and you know, you can't say, but we would say that looking at the resources like the Icarus Project that you just told about, it took me like 7 years to melt down. But, you know, some people can do it in a shorter time than that. You know, some people do it in a year or whatever. But, you know, we're not saying that you know, listen to this radio broadcast and then say, oh, I'm not going to take my medication tomorrow. There is a responsible way, because there is a withdrawal. And a lot of these cases where we have people, that's what they will say. Oh, they stopped taking their medication. But there's a withdrawal process. Just because this is a prescription does not mean that you don't have the withdrawal that everyone else has. And even with the weight gain, I fight that now, even though the medication caused me to have the weight gain. It's been a long time since I've had it. Your body has memory. And certain things, heart condition, arthritis, these things, they're there. And they don't tell you that. They don't tell you up front that these things are going on. Like I said, that little 2-inch or 3-inch thing you get from the pharmacy is not enough. You need the manufacturer's insert, and you need to have long conversations with someone about it, and to say, is there anything else that I can take other than taking these chemicals? Is there anything else that I can do? You know, I think it's a horrible thing that when these killings occur, and this always drums up, but I also think that when someone, especially the last couple of shooters who have had access to mental health was not a problem for the California shooter. It wasn't a problem for the guy in Newtown, where his father was vice president of a Fortune 500 company and probably had better life insurance. His insurance was probably right up there with the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say for the Murphy bill, if they wanted to do something to help, they would provide more money for these other interventions that we have that people do voluntarily that would help people. Versus things you've described where it's very painful, where you've lost a portion of your life. If you were in an automobile accident, you'd be getting a multimillion-dollar settlement.
Right. Right. That's exactly what, you know, the point I try to make to my family. You know, if I'd been hit by a drunk driver, you know, I wouldn't feel so desperate because action would have been taken. And I couldn't do anything. I tried to get lawyers. I did contact a couple of lawyers in Philadelphia, and you know, there's nothing. There's really. This was probably a year and a half afterwards, but there was nothing I could do legally. I did try to do that, but and I would feel a little better if I had some kind of financial
and legal recourse. You were damaged and you should be able to be compensated for that damage.
Right.
And of course they've made it in all of their books that you can't do that or anyone can't do that. You know, I'm just looking at this article that came out about, I don't know, nine hours ago on CNN, titled Competing Mental Health Bills Set Up Partisan Showdown. And so, you know, your statement earlier about it being political is right on the money. But they're talking about Congressman Tim Murphy's bill, H.R. 3717, that would eliminate things like recovery-oriented services, alternatives. Murphy directly went after the Hearing Voices Network, among other organizations and efforts for people's rights to be protected. The bill slashes protection advocacy for individuals diagnosed with a psychiatric label. But in this article, it says that meaning Murphy's bill, has the backing of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the American Psychiatric Association, and the National Sheriff's Association, among other groups. And so you have the National Alliance on Mental Illness, who is a front for the drug companies, and where exposés have shown that the majority of their funding is coming from a nonprofit organization whose funding is coming from the pharmaceutical companies to push the drugs. And then you have the American Psychiatric Association supporting it, who is undoubtedly going, their members will secure their positions and their necessity to the world for this fraud that they're perpetrating. And then the National Sheriff's Association, which will increase court fees, increase time on the job, increase what Yvonne calls this unholy alliance between mental health and the law. And so these are the people, like when you really, really reorganize what's going on and who are the people who are supporting this, these are the people supporting it. And this is all going on in the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee. That is where this is happening. And it's a direct response to the Sandy Hook shootings in Newtown in Connecticut in 2012. And every time one of these sensationalized stories, I just want to say that every time there is another mass shooting, they haul it out as if it is the only time this ever happens. But in 2010, which is the most recent numbers I've been able to find, I'm sure there are more recent numbers somewhere, there were over 10,000 murders in the United States. And we don't hear about those every day because they don't sell newspapers and they don't enhance anybody's opportunity to go after a group of people to control.
Lauren, most of the victims, in these cases, if you notice all these massacres, as they call them, mostly they're white males. Mostly the victims are white.
That's
and
right.
Many of these other 10,000 cases you have, many of the victims, they are not white.
That's right.
I have a high school. I can have a high school near me, and they may have 18 shooting deaths in the high school in the whole year. Now, how is that different than where someone else, where they may have 15 or 16 people in one day?
That's right. And we're kidding ourselves, and anybody who thinks that that's not the reality of what's going on here to some degree is kidding themselves. And then also doubly, the people who this is happening to, particularly this last Elliot Rodger, which I've seen a lot of really interesting commentary on concerning misogyny and sexual entitlement and other cultural and social mm-hmm. issues that are occurring that were behind this, including, you know, they keep saying Hollywood did it. And it's not Hollywood. It's being the son of somebody who is powerful in Hollywood, growing up in that environment, being the son of the person who was the assistant director of The Hunger Games, one of a violent movie, playing World of Warcraft 6 hours a day in order to escape reality. Like, these mm-hmm. kinds of things are being, you know, thrown into the mix every now and then, mm-hmm. but all they're riding on is, you know, the quote-unquote ticking time bomb, the madman mm-hmm. who's going to go out and get this, and the institutional and structural racism and classism that is at the base of this. The majority of people that laws like H.R. 3717 will affect are not going
They'll
to be people who are wealthy. It may be people who are from every, you know, race and gender and everything, but it is not going to be people who are wealthy who are going to be subjected to this. And it is another way for the powerful to create further oppression on groups that are already historically, systemically mm-hmm. oppressed. And people need to just wake up and realize that this is so much of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And, Lauren, one of the things that we don't know too much about is this, is that there are some people that are just bad and evil. I mean, there was a case, I can't remember what state it was in, but they had coined this term, affluenza, where there was
right.
a young man from another privileged family, and he had an automobile accident, and the judge put him in a nice facility. The parents are paying for it.
He didn't have an automobile accident. He was drunk, and he killed people. He was drunk and he killed people, and he got away with it because he had, quote-unquote, affluenza and didn't know how to deal with adult responsibility because of his wealth, that his wealth was a disadvantage to him in following the law.
Yeah, and that's before the judge. And he's going to be in a place where they have tennis courts and swimming pools and everything like that. And what I'm trying to bring up is that it is unequal. You have, it is not right. The common denominator in this is guns. And the fact is that we are never going to be able to resent all bad things happening to everybody, and for the mm-hmm. numbers don't bear mm-hmm. out that having to have this kind of coercive and involuntary torture of people just, and I don't say because anybody loses their son or daughter, that's not insignificant to them, but to have this so that the rights of most people, anybody who goes for some marriage counseling or grief counseling or something else might be, you know, susceptible to having this kind of intervention on them, or the same thing that this caller is talking mm-hmm. about, where they have had put things put in their brain, they had electroshock, and we think that this is something out of a science fiction movie. But it's not, and we got to do something to break up the unholy alliance, number one, and number two, to break up this idea that there's some correlation between mental health and prevention of violence. There's not. There is no correlation there.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a case, we would be acting on a lot of other issues. We'd be able to, and to be able to try to do this, this young man was under treatment. And we don't need more law enforcement. It would have been helpful.
Yeah.
And he was not under treatment for a psychiatric label. It's very important for people to understand this. The person that they are basing all of this law on, that they are sending out to the media, did not have a psychiatric label. He was diagnosed with an autistic spectrum disorder, which is a developmental disability, still in the diagnostic statistical manual,
mm-hmm.
but it is a different thing. And the idea that all people need to be concerned, because there is nobody who they're going to be able to, there's nothing that's going to prevent you from getting these kinds of labels. But the fact is that he was not being treated for a psychiatric label. And that is something that is very important for people to – in fact, the diagnosis that the news is saying that he had was, quote-unquote, Asperger's. And Asperger's, as a diagnosis, doesn't even exist anymore. So the thing that they said he had, that they were, you know, that he was in treatment for all these years, doesn't even, you know, was, you know, swallowed up by the larger and problematic diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. And so
the telephone number is 267-521-0167. So if you would like to call in and be part of the conversation, and we understand that some people need to listen in for some sessions before they feel comfortable to come in, but the number again is 267-521-0167, and that's every night from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time. I'm sorry. Continue.
Thanks. Yeah, and I'd also like to say that on June 4th, Jason, you might be interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
On June 4th, from 8 to 10 p.m., we're going to have a special show at a special time, 8 to 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern,
okay.
where we're going to be focusing on electroshock as a crime against humanity. And guests mm-hmm. on that show include Sue Clark Wittenberg of the International Campaign to Ban Electroshock,
mm-hmm.
Don Wheats of the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault in Canada and Phoenix Rising, George Ebert of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, Dr. Brenda LeFrancois from Canada, and Dr. John Breeding from the United States. And also Loretta Wilson, who's going to be giving an update about the current level status of the FDA for the the actual device being a level 3 device and them trying to
mm-hmm.
drop it to a level 2 device.
Mm-hmm.
We have another caller from area code 303. If you're there, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, it's Renee, the nurse from Colorado.
Hey, Renee, how are you?
Hi, I'm getting a little bit of an echo.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. I just kind of thought, I really just felt compelled to kind of call in, and the gentleman that is on your show, I just really kind of wanted to call and just, you know, apologize. I'm a nurse.
Mm.
I just want to validate everything that you said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened to you. You're not crazy to think it's torture. I know that you were really traumatized with what happened to you, and I just wanted to say that I'm sorry that happened to you.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You know, there are people out here that, you know, I did work in a psychiatric hospital for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and I saw the truth of what went on in there, so I just
mm-hmm.
wanted to validate that experience, you know, if it's worth anything to say that I saw what happens, you know, I saw what happens, and I saw the truth of what happens in psychiatric hospitals, and
mm-hmm.
and it's really kind of like the biggest realization, I think, of my entire life, that people can be treated that way. And so hopefully
mm-hmm.
all of us together, you know, people that have worked in those situations and saw the truth of what happens, and people like yourself can continue to speak out until society kind of starts to get it, that, you know,
mm-hmm.
all of our rights are tied together. This
mm-hmm.
isn't an us and them thing. It's all of us. These laws can affect anybody at any time, really. And so
mm-hmm.
I just kind of felt compelled to call in and say that I'm sorry that happened to you. I'm sure it's still going on, too. I'm sure the realization is still going on.
The more I, follow these issues and consider what happened to me, it's a constant, it really is a unfolding realization of lots of different things. Trying to figure out where, how this fits into everything else.
I myself, I am kind of going through the same struggle, really. There's a term that is used sometimes for people. So I think a lot of people anyway kind of know that at least 90% of people that go into the hospital have had some kind of a trauma history and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we're just, I think, just starting to kind of realize that a lot of these things that are quote-unquote mental illness or, how all the horrible terms that they use are actually kind of natural reactions to,
mm-hmm.
to life circumstances. And there's a term that is used a lot. For instance, when I started to kind of realize what I was looking at and what was happening to the people that I've been charged to care for and realize that the treatment, the quote-unquote treatment they're getting is really quite harmful,
mm-hmm.
And traumatizing in itself. There's a term, it's called vicarious trauma, and they say, well, mm-hmm. you're just being bothered. You're having vicarious trauma because you've heard this person's talking about abuse mm-hmm. they've been through or things like that. And I,
mm-hmm.
I started to realize I'm not having vicarious trauma here. I'm being traumatized by the quote-unquote treatment that I'm
mm-hmm.
seeing. You're telling me this person needs this, and all I'm seeing is the torture that you're talking about,
Mm-hmm.
I witnessed somebody suggest electroshock for a patient, and I don't mean to say patient, for a person,
mm-hmm.
just because she didn't agree with where she was being discharged to.
And it's
really subhuman treatment. It's not seeing people as humans, and I think
mm-hmm.
a lot of people really they don't understand what goes on behind locked doors,
mm-hmm.
and it's really scary. And I hope that you'll continue to speak out because your story, just as you told it, was really quite moving, and I think a lot
mm-hmm.
of people would benefit from hearing it.
I'll keep I've kind of vowed not to continue to speak about it because that's what helped me, really, it's really saved my life to all the other stories of people who have gone through it, the insulin shock and electric shock and things. There are lots of other people who've, so that's what I want to do is kind of be a witness. I feel, morally compelled to talk about it and continue to speak about it. I'm glad that other people, have before me. I mean, all the people, who had it, who experienced this in the, 50 years ago and are still talking about it, that's helped me survive because I was never suicidal or homicidal or violent or angry or no one ever considered me dangerous until after the electroshock, because I can understand why they would use that. It makes you, it really destroys your identity, and it makes you easily controllable. So if you're depressed or if you're struggling and your problem to other people, this can really, shut you up and make you feel so helpless that you have no choice but to listen to other people. And, I think some of my aggression and other things that happened afterwards were, slowly realizing, you know, coming out of it after about 6 or 9 months, slowly realizing what had happened and the horror of it, you know, and some of my aggression and things like that were just resisting what was happening, what I have to face now and stuff. So I don't know. And it all looked so good. I mean, it's the hospital where I was. This is really a University of Pennsylvania is a really highly respected world teaching hospital, and I thought I was safe. I thought I was going in for help. I thought I was going to feel better, and I got sold a bill of goods.
What a betrayal!
And, yeah.
Next well, I want to tell you, the and I apologize.
Now.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm kind of getting a little echo, so I apologize. I just really want to validate that, from what I saw working in the psychiatric hospital, what you're saying is true. Okay, I saw people get sold a bill of goods. I
mm-hmm.
saw people gently coerced.
I saw
doctors write things in records in order to give people medication that would keep them quiet that didn't fit their diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
I saw people restrained because they were objecting, rightfully so, to what was happening to them. And,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a symptom. What
mm-hmm.
they were saying was true, and their objections were valid. And, it's really sad that self-advocacy is considered a sign of getting your health back, I guess, in a way. I don't know, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put my foot in my mouth or anything. If self-advocacy is a sign of health, and
mm-hmm.
but if you try to advocate, it becomes a symptom. So you're in an impossible double bind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I really I'm so happy that you're finding your voice, that you found your voice, and I hope that I think you will, and I know you said that you look forward to continuing to speak out, because I think people really need to hear your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to interrupt your guys' call for long. I think I'll go ahead and get off the line, but I just wanted to really apologize because, as a nurse, our code of ethics is that we have to stand for our patient. No matter what, if there's a conflict
mm-hmm.
between the doctor and the patient, we're supposed to stand with our patient. And again, I don't view anybody as a patient. I see you as people, but I'm talking about in our code of ethics, it says, you will stand with the patient. And
mm-hmm.
I really think that, that nursing has really failed when it comes to psychiatric care, and it's disappointing for me. Professionally,
Renee, before you go, I'm just wondering, from your perspective as a nurse, are you familiar with HR 3717, the Murphy Bill?
I am familiar with it because of all of my activist friends. Yes, I've been involved in a little bit of a legal case myself, trying to bring a case against the hospital that I worked for. So. I haven't been able to keep up as much as I want to. Well, it seems like all these laws are being passed very quickly, even in my own home state of Colorado. But, yes, I am familiar with it.
So
I do not advocate for so many of the things in that bill.
I'm just wondering your perspective around forced treatment, the involuntary outpatient commitment piece that would require all states to have an involuntary outpatient commitment law in order to be able to use it as a bargaining chip to give states money, and if they don't comply, then they don't get money. Do you have any perspective from the position of a nurse about forced psychiatric intervention?
I would have to say that from everything that I've learned, especially from people that have survived the psychiatric system, that there is no way in heck that I could ever agree with something like that. The amount of abuse that I saw at the hands of providers. I don't, you know, laws that rely on a professional always doing the right thing and always having goodwill, that is not enough protection of civil rights for me. I know that it could be me anytime and that all of our rights are tied together. So if somebody comes after your rights, they're coming after my rights. I take it very personally. And I don't enjoy my rights being stepped on. And so, no, I don't support I guess you'd call it ACT or involuntary outpatient treatment, assertive community treatment, however you want to call it. People don't have any choice as it is. Whatever laws are on the books, if the doctor wants to drug you, you're going to get drugged. If the doctor needs to lie in court to get you committed, they're going to lie in court to get you committed. I've seen it. And so I do not support any infringement on anybody's civil rights based on, you know, what's a perceived disability, based on color, based on sexual orientation. I don't support any civil rights infringement. And the fact that it's based on a mental disability it doesn't make that argument invalid. I don't care what it's based on. You can't make a special group of laws for a particular group of people.
Yeah.
It's a very, very dangerous thing to me.
I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this, because you're a nurse.
I'm a nurse.
I'll put you on the spot because I know that nurses are very helpful in hospitals. A lot of people don't realize they really run the show. But from what you do know about nursing, how would you think the practice of being a nurse, also the overall world, if Murphy passed, and I know that you haven't had a chance because you're busy helping people recover, but just some of the things that are in the Murphy, such as doing away with protection and advocacy, people that come in and supposed to help protect the people in institutions and out in the community. If interventions like forced treatment, like forced ACT, forced drugging, force was put in place, and that also one of the features is that there is, I call it unholy alliance, between law enforcement and the medical profession. How do you think that things would look after this was put into effect? How would you imagine this being from where you work or what you're seeing? You already have stated that that there's a certain amount of fraud that already occurs on the part of some of the medical profession. Just in your wildest nightmares, what would you think would be happening?
In my wildest nightmares, I would say that, you know, in my mind, soon enough, anybody, I mean, it seems like anybody can get a medical diagnosis from the DSM, really. And so forced outpatient commitment, I mean, basically a quiet patient is a healthy patient, and you're going to be, you know, somebody is going to come visit you at your home every 2 weeks and give you an injection to keep you nice and quiet and compliant, and then they're going to leave, and you're going to be a prisoner in your own skull, in your own home. It's really disgusts me. I mean, I just want to be totally honest. You have this idea that, you know, even I was taught in nursing school that if somebody recovered from, let's say they were having symptoms associated with the label schizophrenia, and they recovered, that it just meant that they were misdiagnosed.
Right.
And I was taught that in nursing school. And it's all bull.
The whole thing is the fact,
you know,
that it even exists in the first place is, yeah.
And it's like, I think I could have, hey, I had a heck of a childhood. I had, you know, hey, if this one certain person hadn't stepped in at just the right time, it could be me right in your spot.
Yeah.
you know?
And one of the other provisions of the Murphy Bill has to do with taking money from Medicaid to give it to psychiatric hospitals, because the authors of this bill believe that we do not have enough beds, that we are like 50, 70,000 beds short in this country. So I'm quite sure that there would be an increase in need for psychiatric nursing. We would go back to the big, large institutions that we used to have.
What are these? What's being proposed? What are the plans for these new institutions? Because I wasn't aware of that until last night.
Right now, most psychiatric hospitals, their money comes out for a separate pot. But there are other forces that believe that we don't have enough money. And as Lauren was saying earlier in the show, we have partners like Press that are pressing for this. And, you know, people will say that if we just were able to lock people up, and if we had more beds.
Mm-hmm. So that would be more cost-effective than doing this, than coming out to your home and doing it the way they're doing it now? Is that?
Well, what they're saying is take money away from recovery programs and everything.
Yeah.
I would say that it's definitely not a matter of money, because in the hospital that I worked at, it was $268,000 a year per person.
About the same
thing.
There
was no active treatment going on. It was just drugging, and that's it. So $268,000 a year per person, and people literally were begging for saltine crackers when they were hungry.
Yeah.
It's much more cost effective. Recovery is much more cost effective. So it's kind of, to me, it's a matter of political will. The money argument doesn't hold up. From what I know, and I don't know everything. I only, you know, I know what I've learned from people that have been through the system, who I consider the experts, and I know what I've seen in the system.
Well, that's the plan. If Murphy goes through, that's one of the plans, is to go back to the large institutions, and many of these proponents of this, are considered to be, by some people, they tout them as experts, but they claim that we need that because they want to actually, they say it in a kind of benevolent way. They said they want to move people out from the, and if you work in a hospital, which I've worked in two hospitals, they want to move people from the jails to the psychiatric.
I've
seen what when we have the move, sometimes very violent people to people where they're very vulnerable in a psychiatric hospital. Some people, I believe that there's a reason why they're in jail. Everybody that has a mental health diagnosis, the crime that they committed may not be related to their mental illness. But,
and I don't really support the violence argument either, because my first, you know, they're trying to relax the standards for people to be committed here in Colorado. And my first, and I do have emergency room experience, and my first thought when I saw that law come across the table was, this argument is totally false. If you're talking about wanting to get rid of violence, I mean, just give me the list of everybody that was in jail last night for abusing their spouse. Because I'm not speaking scientifically or anything right now. I'm just talking about that was my first instinct, because I would see patients come in over and over who had been beaten up by their spouse, you know, knives and threats and ropes and strangling and everything that you would see working in an emergency room. And I'm thinking, you're relaxing these standards because you're telling me that this, you know, quote-unquote, this population of people is violent, but why am I seeing this population come in beat up and raped and everything else? And it, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. The violence argument doesn't hold up.
No, it's complete fraud. The same way psychiatry is a complete fraud. I mean, you know, here we are again of people who are really in need of assistance, who are being abused or raped or tortured or beaten in their own situations, are then winding up in a system of where they're like legally, you know, abused and tortured all over again. And raped. I mean, let's not play for 2 seconds like rape isn't an issue in psychiatric institutions, because it sure as hell is. So,
yeah.
So with the expansion of things, you know, if Murphy gets his way with HR 3717, it will just increase the rate of people who are going to be subject to it. And you know, we were talking a little bit about Colorado last night, Renee, and about the loss where they're trying to take the word imminent out from the phrase imminent danger, so for anybody who can be brought in, and that is really frightening, because it becomes like from subjective to, I don't even know what's, you know, if you remove imminent, how much more subjective can you get of determination,
right,
of people being hauled in. And then when people really do need, when there is something actual criminal occurring, the police can't spot it, and that's because nobody can predict these things. Nobody can see through somebody who is intentionally doing a criminal act if they're good enough at it.
Well,
and that's not a psychiatric label. That's not a result of, you know, something that was voted on in a room by a bunch of people who have financial interest in the pharmaceutical industries. Crime and violence is not what but what the media is consistently conditioning the country to think it is. And so every time they couple, I mean, it's the most basic thing that any you know, level 100 psychology student would learn, that if you couple a noise with an action, you can condition fear into a person. And so, you know, they do the big bang of, like, whatever sensationalized murder spree they're going to talk about,
mm-hmm.
and then immediately interject 1,000 times mm-hmm. over that this is psychiatric and that psychiatry is real and good and it will help. And
yeah.
before you know it, you have an entire population of people who just buy it, and then you have the advertising and all of the, you know, the pharmaceutical
well,
business.
That's why your show is really so exciting, is because you can have people that have real life experience, like the gentleman that you have on your show now, and say, "Hey, I'm a real person, and this is what happened to me." Because you know, some of the people that are in need of the most help, they're behind locked doors right now. And a lot
right.
of them don't need to be there. And the proper words that need to keep them there are being written down on paper. But they're trapped. And they don't, you know, there's a lot of people that don't need to be there. And so that's why I think it's, you know, much more powerful for you who has had the experience to speak up than it is for someone like me to say, hey, I don't think this is right, because in some people's minds, they think, oh, well, this person, they're just out of their mind. This is just what they need. They need the drugs. They need to go in the hospital. Well, it's just not true. Here we are all talking. you
right.
know, here we all are.
And Jason,
we're real people. We're having real conversations about real things that happened. So you can't just continue to say, the more people that speak up, you can't just continue to say, hey, it's just these people that have no control over what they're doing. It's just simply false.
Great. And Jason, I also would like to really thank you for calling in and for sharing and for coming to the protests. I'd like to let everybody know that there are going to be a few events that are coming up in the near future. If you're going to be at Left Forum on this weekend in New York City, I'm presenting on a panel with Seth Farber and others about the anti-psychiatry's challenge to the left, Lang, Saz, and the MAD movement. June 19th will be the 6th anniversary of Esmond Green's murder at Kings County Hospital Center's Psychiatric Emergency Room in Brooklyn. And we are going to be holding a vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green and all others who have lost their lives to psychiatry. On from July 13th at 6 p.m. until July 16th at 6 p.m., the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance will be hosting the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Days demonstration and vigil. We will be sitting vigil for 72 hours because 72 hours is how long most states can detain, assess, and treat you before determining whether or not you need to be institutionalized. And we will be holding vigil July 13th to the 16th on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And if you'd like to get involved in organizing or supporting that or coming or finding out more information, you can get in touch with the Alliance at 800-654-7227, 800-654-7227. And then finally, July 24th to the 27th in Connecticut will be Mind Freedom International's 2014 Creative Revolution Conference. And if you'd like more information about that, you can find that at www.mindfreedom.org. If you'd like to, and then I just want to say, if you'd like to leave a tip, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. So if you know about a human rights violation that you'd like to have attention brought to, or if you have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest, call area code 718-273-8708, 24 hours a day except when we're on air. And that there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of ways for people to get involved and speak out, and that we have to create an independent avenue to the mainstream media because they need to be held accountable for what it is they're doing and how it is they're psychiatrically profiling us and creating these laws that are going to cause a loss of liberty for all people who are living here. And if it happens in one state, it will happen in another. And the national H.R. 3717, the Murphy Bill, absolutely must be stopped.
Lauren, don't forget, we should ask people to call their congressperson to ask them not to support that bill.
That's right. There are ways you can get involved just by reaching out to your legislators, your congressmen, specifically on women, and tell Congress that you want to stop H.R. 3717, that this is not the solution that this country needs, that this is a veil based on fraud and huge profit for those who are involved at the loss of human rights and civil liberties for people who are subjected to it. So you call your local people, your Congress people, and they work for us, and we need to remember that. And as a person who lives in someone's district, you have the power of the vote, and that is a power that you can utilize and that you can make a difference today. And we really need to get the truth out about what psychiatry is doing and what it can and cannot do. And certainly with all that it cannot do, we shouldn't be creating laws to force it on people.
The most effective way, this is Yvonne, most effective way is to send a handwritten letter is the most effective way. But if you cannot, or if you're just thinking about this right now, go to your congressperson's website, and you can go to U.S. House of Representatives and just put that into Google and enter, and you will be able to find out that you usually have a link for messaging for you to message your congressperson and to explain to him that your opposition to this particular bill. And you might add, that not only yourself is against this bill, but your family members or organization you belong to. So the email would be another way of doing it, but the most effective way is to have a handwritten letter. I have to remind people that every single day that people that want to take away our human rights and to take away the recovery-oriented, trauma-informed programs we have, they are on TV. Every hour they're on TV somewhere telling their false about the fact that if they could only have the power to make people be engaged in treatment. And if you've listened to the show tonight, you've heard we're in, and many of us have these personal experiences where we know that force does not, it will not stop everything. It is just like trying to find a sewing needle in somebody's house and saying, I'll burn the whole house down. So please, go to the U.S. House of Representatives site if you don't know who your a congressperson is and say that you object to H.R. 3717 and that you would prefer that they support measures that would give more money for recovery-type services and protect protection and advocacy for all citizens. Please do that. If you do nothing else, if you cannot do anything else, go to the website and do that. If you have a little bit more time, write a letter. Have a letter-writing party. A lot of us are isolated, wherein, you know, a lot of people are not involved in it. Advice friends and family over for a letter-writing party to write letters to your congressperson. This is going to affect everybody. And it's not any turning back once we open the doors. Anyone can be picked up. And we're not saying that this is not a matter of access. Access is limited by the dollars that are involved. And I hope that you stay tuned to the Lauren Tenney Show that is on every night between 9 and 11 o'clock. And you'll get other tips on how that we can stop the Murphy Bill over the coming days. This is not going to go away. We oftentimes relax. There is some event that causes the people to beat the bushes for this kind of coercive type of intervention. I don't even like to call it treatment. In fact, one of my common sayings is that assisted outpatient treatment, they use those words, but it's not treatment. It's a judicial process. We saw this in the 1930s in Germany when they started doing this with people who were mentally ill, then they moved on to Jehovah's Witness, they moved on to gypsies, and then they moved on to ethnic groups. And so this is something we have seen happen before. And once the doors open, there's a reason why we have protection and advocacy, because there were abuses in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And if we go back to having those large institutions again, I mean, Lord help us.
I mean, I think, Yvonne, what you're saying really needs to be just hit home to the public. The person who knows nothing about any of this, has never had any involvement in the psychiatric system, doesn't really have an opinion about it one way or the other even. But just to understand that if this occurs, that immediately what will happen is that people who are, quote, not fit to live, to walk the streets with other people will be picked up and put in institutions for the rest of their lives. We're not going to be talking about involuntary outpatient commitments anymore, because they are going to get what they want, which is, quote, reinstitutionalization. And the people that are pushing this, like the treatment advocacy center,
it's not even people that are not fit to walk among us. It could be anyone. You could be in a custody fight with your...
But the way that they're selling this is that it's some, you know, other group of people that exist that you're not part of, that you, the public, are not part of this. We're talking about some quote-unquote other person. And the truth is just what Yvonne was saying, is that it could be any one of us. And anyone could be there and then locked up for life for having committed no crime. And while some of the time there are definitely emotional experiences that people are having and struggles and sadness and loss and loneliness that mm-hmm. prompts this, there's also plenty of people who are locked up because they believe that they've had a spiritual experience or because mm-hmm. their political views aren't in line with the political views of the people around them, and that this mm-hmm. is a socially mediated kind of thing. There is absolutely no blood test. There is no brain scan.
The guy that keeps going through his city council complaining about not having a stop sign, and he's just not in the swing of things. I mean, it's ripe for abuse. I am in the bedroom of the psychiatric hospital that we have here in the district, and I know people that have been there 60, 70 years. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. in this past, some of my friends who've been there for a long time, they have died. There are people, they tell me, they say, Yvonne, you know, we don't keep people in the hospital anymore like that. I said, well, yes, we do. We do have people who are in the hospital for long lengths of time. And then they say, well, those people are forensic. I said, some of them are, some of them are not. Some of them that even are forensic have petty crimes, like eating at a salad bar
right.
or whatever else, you know. Someone goes in and they're at 16, their parents die in the meantime. There's no one for them to be leased to. There mm-hmm. is too many horror stories that we cannot prevent. We have to decouple this violence prevention from mental health. If you want to help people
yeah.
that need extra help, then what you need to do is provide money for it that's outside of Medicaid rather than robbing the community dollars now, rob them to set up an extra 70,000 or 100,000 beds, which for me sounds like we're not just having reinstitutionalization, is we're going to try to go back to a day where we have like concentration camps.
Right.
But I want to give out my phone number, 202-758-5575. I'm in Washington, and Washington, D.C. And I'm trying to work with Lauren. I'm working on some articles and some press information, and I'm hoping to share it with Lauren so that we could help break down this misinformation that the press is giving. Do not think that you are too small, that you yourself cannot do anything. We have to be in this fight, because if this bill is passed, and even if it's defeated, we cannot give up. We have to be vigilant, because there are people out there that are absolutely convinced that there is a plague and that
yeah.
there are people who just are not aware that they are ill and that they need to be brought in.
Right, the benevolence that hides behind this, and Jason, like you were saying, that everything looked beautiful and everybody, you know, that there was a benignness to the way they presented
mm-hmm.
what was happening, that
mm-hmm.
people are being lied to and betrayed, and that we
mm-hmm.
need to stop perpetuating this fraud. The mainstream media must be held accountable. They cannot
mm-hmm.
continue to call us schizophrenics or madmen or... ticking time bombs just waiting to go off. If you've been listening, I know you've all been listening, because this show that's been on just a little bit under 2 weeks has been downloaded over 1,700 times already amongst the ten shows that have gone on so far. And so
yeah.
people are listening. I know you're listening. And I'm asking you to call and talk to me and to tell me what you think should be done, and to help break the silence about psychiatric oppression. I think the more that we can attempt to create avenues for people in society who aren't involved with any of this psychiatric nonsense, to hear our stories and see our accomplishments, and for us to also, most importantly, for anybody who's listening who is in the psychiatric involvement, involuntarily, there are networks of people who have gotten out at points in all of our lives. I guarantee you, we thought that we couldn't, and you can.
Mm-hmm.
you can do whatever you want, and together, collectively, we're going to continue building our voices, and we're not going to stop. And
we want to hear your stories.
And so,
what are you doing to what are you doing to fight? Just like the gentleman here. In other words, we're trying to get this out. Even one person can do a whole lot.
That's absolutely right. And so if you'd like to call in tomorrow night, we will be on from 9 to 11, and it will be open lines about current events and state-sponsored psychiatric systems. And so the number will be 267-521-0167. Jason, Renee, Yvonne, and anybody else who's out there listening, thank you so much. Keep on talking. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Lauren. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jason. Jason, contact me offline so that we can maybe coordinate around stuff.
Okay. How can I do that? Is it your email or phone?
My email is laurentenney@aol.com, and my phone, which happens to also be the tip line, is area code 718-273-8708.
718-273-7108.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be tuning in tomorrow, and I will contact you to see what else, if there's anything
and
else I can
call,
do.
Call in the show anytime. Anytime.
Okay. I'll definitely be listening nightly. I mean, definitely. So.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. And Renee, I'll talk to you too. Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.